There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, you guys. So I had something very dramatic happen to me in the past couple weeks. I had my 60th birthday party. Oh my, I'm 60. How did that happen? I mean, do you sit there at birthdays and think to yourself, wait a minute, how did this actually happen? Because in my mind, I'm still a co-ed at Berkeley. Well, that shows how old I am. I'm still using the term co-ed. I'm just a college kid having fun and doing, you know, Orange Theory and jumping around. But that said, this has really made me feel, doing this podcast, just so good about bringing these stories to you of success, failure, and then success, the climb, how extraordinary people who are in the public eye at the top of their game, how they did it, so that you realize you can do it too. It just takes this a voluminous amount of work and stick-to-itiveness and grit. And so I got another one for you, and you are going to be riveted because I told you so. So I'm going to start with a multi-pronged quiz leading into this. I'm about to give it to you. You ready? Okay, you have to listen closely. What do actors Robert Downey Jr., Eva Longoria, Charlie Sheen, reality stars Paris Hilton, Nicole Richie, what do they all have in common with NBA star Lamar Odom, boxer Oscar De La Hoya? Okay, I know it's getting long, but keep going. Major League Baseball stars Jose Canseco, Daryl Strawberry, football king, right, back in the day, O.J. Simpson. Yes, we know all about O.J. I'm still not done. Casino magnate Steve Wynn, Viacom founder Sumner Redstone, and gambling magnate Steve Wynn. I'm still not done. I'm almost done. And finally, what do they all have in common with rock stars David Lee Roth, Smokey Robinson, and Chaka Khan? They all turned to one man when they needed a lawyer. That lawyer, Robert Shapiro. He is known internationally as one of the best litigators in the world. And time again, he stood before juries and systematically filleted prosecutors' cases against his clients. He's famous for staring down huge press gaggles and bluntly defending his clients' innocence. With such a flair for drama, is it any surprise that no fewer than four actors, including John Travolta, have portrayed him in movies? It's like he was born to be a criminal defense attorney, right? Far from it. Growing up in Plainfield, New Jersey, he went off to college to UCLA to earn his degree in finance. So what was the hairpin turn of life that brought him face-to-face with a career in law? And how, at the height of his fame, did he deal with the worst loss any parent could ever have? Robert Shapiro's story is one of grit, surprises, tragedy, success, hope. He's here today to talk about embracing success and fighting through grief. Robert, welcome to Everyone Talks to Liz.
Thank you so much for that most generous introduction. And more importantly, happy birthday. I think your mother must have lied on your birth certificate and decided you should be a little bit older so you could advance through school more quickly.
I think you have her card. She did that. She lied about my age, my little brother's age, and one of my older sister's ages, because she, five kids, she was like, get to school already. So she kind of pushed it up so that it was before the cutoff date. So you're right.
Well, you know, I mean, it's pretty easy to determine that. All you have to do is look at you, and, and obviously, you know, your age is not what's on your birth certificate.
Well, thank you. That's the kind of compliment I really need right now. But, oh, my gosh, you know, you, when I think about all of these, I mean, celebrities are just a corner of all of the clients you've had, but you really run the gamut when it comes to celebs. I mean, Paris Hilton to Chaka Khan, which popped into my mind. Why did Paris Hilton need your services?
Well, Paris Hilton, I was really behind the scenes in Paris Hilton. which I do many times, because sometimes the profile of a quote-unquote high-powered attorney takes away from the client themselves. And Paris had this unfortunate incident where she was granted probation on a old case. She violated the probation, and a very mean-spirited judge put her in jail for, I think, 30 or 60 days.
Mm-hmm. This is coming back to me. I do actually remember this. This is a long time ago, but I remember them throwing her in the clink, probably because he thought he needed to send some type of message that we're all held to the same standard.
No, you know what the message is? They're held to a higher standard. There's not one other person that, number one, that would go to jail when the jails are overcrowded. Mm. The sheriff routinely releases people early, and that person would never have come to the court's attention. But the judge wanted his day in the media, and he got it.
You know, I don't know her, but she works for a living. She's a lovely girl. She really is. Woman now. I mean, she's like the rest of us aging, but not a lot of people know about the early days of Robert Shapiro. So, yeah, you were born in Plainfield, New Jersey, but at a very young age, your parents picked up and moved to Los Angeles. But I need to know about your parents. I mean, what did they do? What were they like? And what was growing up in that household like?
Very, very interesting. My father had two sisters. My mother had was one of six children. My mother was very, very smart, did not go to college, but was politically active and worked in the polls every year, was very proud of doing that, and worked as a sales lady in a department store in the East Coast, and then came out here and worked in an department store. My father was a sensational athlete. Was all-state in basketball and baseball.
Really?
Two things I didn't inherit. But he was a gifted musician, really a child prodigy at the piano. Another thing I didn't inherit, unfortunately. Musicians have a tough time making a living. Especially, you know, if you're a piano player, there's not a great demand. Although people like piano players, it really is very difficult to make a living.
Sure.
So he was one of the first people who actually started a lunch truck business, where he and my grandfather would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, make coffee, get donuts, sandwiches, and start going to factories when people were arriving at work downtown in L.A. at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Huh.
He worked every single day of his life till he was 65, and then decided he would come work for me at the law office, which he did till he retired at about 94 with full faculties, and fortunately lived to 100, a little over 100.
Whoa.
In perfect health.
Oh.
My mother lived to 97. She had slight dementia, but still functioned well, and had a great sense of humor, either directly or indirectly. I was the pride and joy of her life, which many times made me very, very uncomfortable. But she instilled real values with me, as did my father, being wise economically, saving money, living, maybe a little bit below your means, and just doing the right thing and being a good person.
And working really hard, that work ethic.
Yeah. And the work ethic is something that I did inherit.
I can tell. And I use the term hairpin turn, but I mean, finance, a lot of guys in finance go into law, but what triggered the shift, Robert, when you had the degree in finance, you could have gone to work anywhere at a brokerage or at a bank or gone into the, you know, financier business. What turned you to law school at Loyola?
That is a great question. So I'm thinking about writing an autobiography, and the working title is I Never Wanted to Be a Lawyer.
Okay, it has to be. That's a great title.
And there's a lot of truth to that. When I was at UCLA, I didn't know anything about law. I never had any desire to be a lawyer. But there was an intervening event in 1965 when I graduated, mm-hmm. and that was the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And the UCLA draft board, the draft board was right across the street from UCLA. And I was 1A, which is fit and ready to go. And drafting was automatic. Oof. There were four ways to avoid going to Vietnam if you were so inclined. One was to go to Canada, which I had no desire to do. One was to burn your draft card and take a chance with the federal authorities, which I did not want to do. One was to become a conscientious objector, which I would have to lie to do that. Hmm. And the other was to get a deferment to age 35 to go to graduate school.
Oh.
UCLA at the time did not have a graduate school of business. Otherwise, I would have gone there. And so myself and numerous members, not only of my fraternity, but people I knew on campus, sent out massive applications to second and third rate law schools with the hope that we would get accepted. No preparation whatsoever.
Oh my God. I
doubt if I got above a meaningful score on the LSAT. And three of us got accepted to the University of San Diego.
Okay.
A third-rate law school, but with a nice view overlooking the ocean in San Diego. And the first day I'm there and I get a call from Loyola that one seat opened up in the day school. And I said, guys, you know, I can work. I won't have to have student debt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hopefully we can find another roommate for you. But I'm moving back to L.A. I'm going to live at home and go to night school. First day at night school, they came to me and said, one seat opened in the day school. So, well, you know, that's 3 years instead of 4 years. I'll take a crack at that. And so I enrolled in Loyola as a first year law student, and turned out that I was pretty well suited for one area in law particularly, and that was in advocacy. And so I was fortunate enough to do well in law school. I won the moot court competition. I became the chief justice of the moot court. And I got a very, very high score from a federal judge, very, very tough federal judge named Manny Real. He gave me 100.
Whoa.
And he called me aside and he said, you know, what are you planning on doing? I said, you know, I think I'm going to try to pursue my career in finance and use, you know, the background I have. He said, you should be a trial lawyer. You're a natural.
Whoa.
And so I applied to the local public offices, the district attorney's office, the public defender's office, and the county council. And I got accepted to all three and decided that county council didn't try many cases, so that really was off. Public defenders were more left-leaning and had long hair, which I didn't. And but I figured realistically they would just be going against young DAs and probably not get much experience. And as a prosecutor, you know, I may be exposed to private lawyers that were very good and learn some techniques, and that's what I did. So for the first 18 months, I was a trial lawyer in the district attorney's office.
When did you go into a private practice?
18 months into my career as a deputy district attorney, I was recruited by a lawyer who had probably the biggest criminal law practice in California, maybe one of the biggest in the country at the time.
Who was that?
His name was Harry Weiss, and he was a dapper guy out of vaudeville. I don't even know if he ever went to law school, but he was a tremendous trial lawyer. He was at that time not openly gay, but there was no secret. And he was able to build relationships with prosecutors and judges like no one else, and was able to get fantastic results for his clients, and had carried a caseload of probably 20 to 30 criminal cases a day.
Wow.
5 days a week around the clock. And there was two other lawyers working for him. And I worked for him for about 2 years. And then I decided, you know, I'll take a crack at doing this myself. Hmm. I had good relationships with the judges. In those days, you were able to get court-appointed cases when the public defender had a conflict. Today, there's alternate public defenders and second and third tier conflict lawyers, so nearly impossible. But the next 7 years, being a lawyer, I spent every day in a courtroom for 7 years straight.
This is Everyone Talks to Liz, and we will be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What was the make or break, sort of that big, whoa, who is this guy Robert Shapiro case that you got that really eclipsed everything before then and got you a lot of attention?
So I'm out of the DA's office. I'm a young lawyer. I've got my own private practice. And I get a call at home late at night. Caller says, "This is Liza Minnelli." I said, "Oh, hi, Liza Minnelli. It's very nice that you're calling me, but I would have no idea why you would be calling me." She said, "Well, you know, one of your friends, who is a choreographer, David Winters, is doing a review for Linda Lovelace, who was the first and probably the most famous porn star of all time."
Sure.
Did a movie called Deep Throat, which was the first movie of its kind ever shown in legitimate theaters across the country. And they both have been arrested for possession for sale of cocaine. I knew David Winters because my youngest son and his son went to the same preschool together.
Okay.
And so I guess he was the only lawyer. I was the only lawyer that he knew. And he had a phone call. They reached out to Liza Minnelli. And I rented a private plane and flew to Las Vegas to meet David Winters and the number one porn star of the time, Linda Lovelace.
I'm guessing that case worked out well for them.
It was the first nationally publicized case that I know of. The newspapers carried it, television news carried it. And I brought in an esteemed lawyer from Las Vegas, Harry Claiborne Jr. And the two of us worked on the case, and we were able to get all charges dismissed. It was clear to me that it was a setup, that they didn't want Linda Lovelace anywhere near Las Vegas. It was run by the mob at that time. And, you know, they were fine with the Follies Bergère, but Linda Lovelace was another story that put them over the edge. So I believe it was a setup when we went to ask to have this large amount of cocaine analyzed. Somehow it disappeared from the locker room.
Oh, convenient.
So we were fortunate to prevail in that case.
I wanted to ask you, because I've always been curious about jury selection. You know, I had a co-anchor at CNBC when I first started in business news who used to joke that the way to get out of jury duty is when you're getting queried by both lawyers, you look at the suspect and say, I don't know, the guy just looks guilty to me. And immediately you're going to get kicked off. But how do you pick people in a jury pool? And how are you able to spot those in the jury pool who may be, for example, in a high-profile case, are so eager to sit on the jury that they hide what they really think might get them booted?
That's a very, very interesting question. First, in the high-profile cases and when clients can afford it, which is generally most of my practice, we bring in a jury selection expert. Probably the most famous is Dr. Phil. That's how he started out.
Huh.
He was a consultant for juries. And so I developed relationships with some of the top jury selection experts who help with filling out questionnaires for potential jurors and coming up with a balanced mix. But my approach is a little bit different than a lot of lawyers I see. Number one, I don't use any notes. I try to talk to people on a even keel. And my theory is that if I can take my client out of the case and put my credibility on trial, I have a better than average chance of winning cases.
Mm.
And that turned out to be true. You know, there's no magic in picking out jurors. But if you get people to talk to you, which is really the key. I mean, if you start out and do this hornbook type of voir dire, which is the way we use a fancy term for talking to jurors, which means to tell the truth.
Right.
You know, can you be fair and impartial? Well,
who's going to say no?
I don't want somebody just to tell me, of course, I can be fair and impartial. I want people to tell me, you know, I want you to look me straight in the eye. And if you believe that we present the case that I tell you we're going to present, that if you believe the prosecution hasn't reached their burden, you would have no trouble in coming up with a not guilty verdict. And that's how I start. And then I continue on that path of taking my client out of the case and putting myself on trial to the degree that, you know, I'll point to him and I'll say, you know, I'll bet you think he must be guilty if he's sitting here, even though you're going to be instructed he's presumed to be innocent. He must have done something, right? And they'll all nod, yes, of course he must have done something. And then I explain what the procedure is for bringing a criminal case. And in many times, it's just a young deputy district attorney filling out a form and filling out charging documents. Or it's a grand jury that the defense had no chance of putting any evidence in front of.
Right.
And so it's really an art in being able to pick a jury and let a jury know that you're going to deliver on every single thing you say in your opening statement.
If picking a jury is an art, is it, once you're in the courtroom, theater? And I say that, and that's not disrespectful, but isn't litigating like acting, Robert? I mean, opening statements and closing arguments, I've covered so many trials. They can make or break moments, and you have to grab the jury's hearts and minds with a vice grip, with eye contact and, you know, great lines, things that they will remember. Do you rehearse for those?
I don't, but I just have enough confidence in my ability to understand the case, to know the case, to be able to talk to juries without reading from a script. without using PowerPoints. Just a simple, direct approach to relate to people that, you know, I'm no different than you and than you are, other than the fact that I went to law school and I have a law degree. But what we're going to talk about today is credibility. And who do you believe at the end of the day? I don't view myself as an actor. In fact, I think I'd be a terrible actor.
You did play yourself in one TV show, right?
I did in several, but, you know, I had a lot of fun doing those things. But I do have a character that that I have developed in court, and my public persona and my courtroom persona is much different than my private persona. Privately, I'm very reserved. I'm not the life of the party. I kind of like to just stay with people I know, mm-hmm. not gregarious. So a lot different than people would have impressions of how they would view me just seeing me on television.
And the most they ever saw you on TV up until that big moment was the O.J. Simpson trial. You know, I covered it as a member of the press, and I was there on the day of the verdict. But, you know, going through that process for you, you are somebody who by then was very mature in your abilities as an attorney. You didn't take on the case for the fame, did you? I mean, you took it on specifically. Why?
You know, it's very interesting that you asked that question. I got a call from a person I did not know. I happened to be at the House of Blues celebrating the anniversary of a good friend of ours, John Paul DeGioia, who started
Paul Mitchell.
And later Patron, and very, very good friend, one of the great philanthropists and wonderful human beings.
He's been a guest on this podcast, Robert, and he was homeless, and he became a self-made billionaire selling hair products out of his car. He's amazing.
Absolutely all true. And I'm sitting there, and the manager of the House of Blues comes up and says, "You have an emergency phone call." And literally my heart drops. I mean, it's a Sunday evening. Mm. Who would know I'm at the House of Blues to begin with? And what could be the emergency? And on the other end of the phone is a very gregarious guy named Roger King. Roger King came from the King family, which at the time had probably the highest rated TV shows. They had Oprah Winfrey, Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty simple. He's loud, he's gregarious, and says, you know, O.J. Simpson's a very dear friend of mine, and he needs the best lawyer, and I hear you're the best lawyer in the country, so I'm hiring you to represent O.J. Simpson. And I said, well, that's very kind of you, and nice to hear from you, Mr. King, but I generally deal with clients. Hold on, I'll get him on the phone. Mm-hmm. Well, can't get him on the phone. He says, I'll get back to you if I get him. An hour later, he's talking again, got me on the phone, and he's got Michael Eisner on the phone, the head of Disney. He says, tell him how rich I am. Tell him I can afford him. Tell him I've got $700 million in the bank. And I said, you know, all that's interesting. But if Mr. Simpson is interested in talking to me, I'll be in my office tomorrow at 8:30. Here's my direct line. And at 8:30, he called. Mm-hmm. And an hour later, I met with him. I met with Robert Kardashian, who was his advisor, not his lawyer. Skip Taft, who was his business lawyer. And, you know, they asked me, what would you do if you were representing Simpson? And, you know, I came up with a list of things that I thought would be really important. Get an investigator in Chicago, get an investigator at LAX, get the manifest from everybody on the airplane, start talking to everybody on the airplane, and get way ahead of the DA's investigation. And they liked it. Simpson liked it, and they asked me to come on board. And so it wasn't something that I gave a lot of thought to. Should I do it? Should I not do it? It was, you know, certainly it wasn't just another day at the office.
No.
That would be absurd to say.
Had you ever litigated a murder trial before? Murder case?
Yes, but not many. But not many. But I had a misconception that I hadn't. But I had done two before. Very unusual that private lawyers who do not take court-appointed cases end up representing people in murder cases, mm-hmm. basically for financial reasons. They're time-consuming. They're complicated. They take a lot of money to properly do them. And so the majority of people who try murder cases are public defenders.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, we've had Ike Sorkin on. He represented Bernie Madoff. He's taken on very unpopular clients. And everybody deserves their day in court and a fair trial. I get that. But there are so many people who don't understand the mind of a criminal defense attorney. And they don't understand how, whether it's you or Ike or any of these guys who get out there and defend, you know, a Ted Kaczynski or somebody like that, the Unabomber, people who've been caught red-handed, how do you decide whether somebody is just not worth your time because you truly believe they're guilty?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. First, there are certain cases that I would not take. Right now, I have not really practiced criminal law for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually last 20 years. I don't want to take a child molestation case. There's certain other sexual cases I wouldn't want to take. Later on in my career, I would not do drug cases. Just personal preference, nothing more, nothing less.
Well, I know why part of your personal preference, not taking drug cases. We should talk about your son. You lost a son to drug addiction, to substance abuse.
Alcohol and drugs.
Alcohol and drugs. Something no parent should ever have to go through.
Well, that's easier to say than to live.
Right.
And it was 17 and a half years ago. It could have been 17 months ago, 17 hours ago, 17 minutes ago. Or 17 seconds ago. It never goes away. And so what my wife and I and our son decided to do was to take this tragedy and turn it into a positive. And we started at the memorial. And at the memorial, the only people that spoke were his friends and myself and his drug counselor. And we all talked about drugs and drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the internment, we had our friends come to the home. And now Roger King's brother, Michael King, comes to me and says, I've been so moved by what I heard today at the memorial that I want to make a substantial donation to your favorite charity. And I said, Michael, you know, I really don't have a favorite charity, but I'd like to start one for drug prevention and drug awareness. And he wrote a check for $25,000. And within 6 weeks, we had the Brent Shapiro Foundation, a 501c3 foundation for drug prevention and drug awareness. And we've been growing that program with the idea that it takes a life to save a life.
It's just amazing to me because you also took it to children. You wrote a children's book about drug addiction, and you donate copies of this to any school that wants them.
I think we had some degree of success in helping pass the Good Samaritan law in California, where if somebody has drugs but is with somebody who is in need of medical attention, they can take them to the hospital. Nobody can get arrested. Nobody can get charged. And we put that on the cards. And so that was the first thing we did, really, to create awareness that alcoholism and chemical dependency are diseases, not unlike any other disease, you know, but it's a disease that has treatment but no cure, much like asthma. That we then decided, you know, what can we do to try to stop the onslaught of kids using substance? Because let's make no secret of it, Liz.
Right.
There is not a place in America that somebody will not be tempted with drugs, period.
Agreed.
It doesn't exist.
And it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic level is.
Well, we developed a little slogan. Be aware, it's everywhere.
It's a good one. This is Everyone Talks to Liz, and we will be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
It feels like that is the kind of action that makes a difference. And I mean, it sounds cliche, but boy, Brent would be so grateful to you for doing this. I'm just blown away. This is a component of you that I didn't know. I know that you became a businessman. You started LegalZoom, which is brilliant. You know, that's really democratizing lawyering and legaling for people, things that they need to do and get done at a much fairer price and level. And I'm just so impressed by that. And I did not know this about you. You have so many different prisms through which to look. I would like to know what you look forward to now. What's next for you?
Well, what's next for me is the foundation and growing the foundation. What I'd like to see eventually is universal testing of kids to the age of 17, that make it as common as putting on a seatbelt when you get into a car, mm-hmm. or putting a helmet on when you ride a bicycle, because that's the only way that parents and teachers are going to be able to know whether or not there really is a problem. With our testing problem, we have over a 99% success rate. We rarely, if ever, have somebody fail a test. If they do, we have counseling. We do not embarrass them. We put them back into the program. The ultimate reward, before we get on to what you just asked me, Liz, mm-hmm. is a college scholarship. Last year, we were able to get one student into UCLA, the hardest school in the country to get into as a freshman. We got one into Berkeley. We got one into Georgetown. This year, we got a student into Brandeis. We got several in the University of California. So we have about 40 kids right now that we are supporting with full four-year scholarships to the college of their choice. We then have a junior scholarship program for junior college and for community college, and those are $5,000 renewable based on grades and achievement. So that's where I want to focus my efforts, and that's where I'd like my legacy really to be, that that we were able to reach out to kids in underserved areas. And the reason it has to be in underserved areas is because the rewards we give to these students are readily available to people who are in the middle class or upper upper class.
Sure.
We take them to college campuses. We take them to ball games. We take them to experiences. But these are experiences that kids that do not live in underserved areas treasure, whereas other kids would say, well, what's the big deal? I just sit at the floor at the Laker game, you know?
Yeah.
There's no incentive for me.
You are helping the helpless. I am honored to talk to you, Robert, and I think you are a good human being. I only really knew you from where everybody knew you, the OJ trial, and I got my personal opinions about that, but as I've gotten to know you now, this, I hope our listeners understand, you have to hear people's real story before you judge them. And I am really proud to be a conduit of your story, Robert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a real pleasure. You know, I enjoy watching you now on the financial channels. You mentioned LegalZoom. I'll just leave you with a humorous story.
Please.
So, four people started LegalZoom. Two lawyers, very, very bright lawyers, Brian Liu and Brian Lee, and an internet genius from Yale named Eddie Hartman. And two very interesting stories about that. The first is, I get a call. They said, you know, are you available to come? We're all going to get our pictures taken. We're going to be on the cover of the California Lawyer magazine. I said, why would we want to be on the cover of the California Lawyers magazine? I mean, they're not sending us any business. They're not people that are particularly fond of us. Brian tells me, oh, no, I've talked to the writer and the editor, and I know them, and it's going to be great. So out comes this magazine, which goes to every lawyer free in California, with the four of us up there smiling, dressed nicely, with the caption, these guys are trying to take you out of business. It happened to be a correct caption.
Well, yeah.
But not you know, look at, I mean, I found that extremely humorous. The other one is really a great story. And one of our partners who was not the lawyer, Eddie Hartman, came to me and said, you know, every time they introduce the founders of LegalZoom, they say it was founded by three guys and this guy, Eddie Hartman. And I said, Eddie, don't. You know, look at this thing can run without any of us except you. I mean, you're the brains behind this thing and make it work. And I said, don't tell me you're thinking of going to law school. He said, no, you know, I heard there's an apprentice program and that, you know, maybe I could sign up and you could tutor me and be my advisor. I said, sure. So the apprentice program, I never heard of anybody ever passing it, but I believe there was historically in World War II, they needed lawyers and that some people became lawyers without going to law school. So it comes time to take the baby bar, and he said, you know, I've never failed a test in my life, and I'm really scared, you know, I'm not that prepared. I said, you know, you're so smart. It's multiple choice. There's five questions. You'll narrow it down to two that are pretty obvious. So you got a 50-50 shot, you know. Just you know, don't sweat it too much. He gets the grade back. He gets the highest grade in the country on the baby bar.
Oh, my.
4 years later, he takes the bar, passes the bar in the first attempt. And I said, great news, you know, I'll take you down to federal court. I know some judges there. We'll get you sworn in right away. Before we can do that, he gets a notice there's an inquiry. And 6 months later, he gets cleared of the inquiry, and he got one of the highest grades in the country on the regular bar. And so they thought he cheated.
Oh, and my God.
The last thing that Carlos Moreno did before he retired from the California Supreme Court was to swear Eddie Hartman in as a lawyer. So, you know, there's always help. Right now, Kim Kardashian has actually passed the baby bar without ever going to law school.
Good for her. Good for her.
So, yeah, very good for her. And so, anyway, that's the LegalZoom story. That, you know, that's one part of my life, the entrepreneurship, which is going back to my roots at UCLA, being a finance major.
I love it. I wanted that piece of it as well, because that is so impressive, especially for me who covers business and entrepreneurship and people who just start something from nothing and really succeed and also do a service for people. Overall, Robert, this is kind of been life-changing for me to talk to you. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing what you have with our listeners who love these kinds of stories. So thank
Well,
you.
you know, look at I view you as a very special person. You were kind enough to interview me a while back on your TV show. And this is, I think, the fourth interview I've given in my career. And so
What?
I'm glad I was able to share some of my stories, hopefully inspiring some people and get them on the right track if they have any addiction issues, to remember that it's not as shameful to have a disease, any disease, and drug addiction, chemical dependency, alcoholism, all fall in that area.
Amen. I'm honored. Now I'm floating. Now I'm levitating. Okay. Now I can brag when I walk out of the studio. Oh my God. Robert, we're going to hang when I get back to Beverly Hills one of these days. Thank you so very much for being on Everyone Talks to Liz.
Well, I'm glad that everyone talks to him, but I'm really, really honored that I'm one of those who got to talk to you. So thank you so much.
You got it. Good health and happiness to you and your
Thank
family.
you.
Thank you. And to all of our listeners, I wish you the same. Want to listen ad-free? You can do it with a Fox News Podcasts Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And then Amazon Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.